Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I think that with the headlines being what they are today, I understand why people despair. I mean, there is a lot going on, as I know firsthand here at the UN, where we've had more emergency meetings and we have more level 3 humanitarian emergencies than we've ever had before in the history of the UN.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power has studied genocide, written about it, seen it firsthand, and here she is reacting to some photos from Syria, hanging on a wall in an out-of-the-way corridor at the United Nations.
It can feel laborious, and it can certainly feel sometimes like you're pushing water uphill, but all you have to do is walk through the Caesar exhibit photos to know why we're here and why it's worth every ounce of energy that we can muster to try to bring about peace.
We will hear more from Ambassador Power, her outrage, her frustration, and her determination to make a difference for the people of Syria in just a moment. But let's take you to the United Nations last Friday, on a snowy afternoon, when the crowds were all excited to see an announced appearance by pop singer Pharrell Williams. The UN was just another squealing selfie moment on a tourist trip to New York City. Williams was late. The snow was intense. But two floors away from the crowds, in a corridor outside where the UN Security Council meets, the footsteps were deliberate. Diplomats moving from office to office. Only occasionally would someone pause to see the somber photos hanging on the wall with a warning. These images are disturbing. And on radio, we can't show them to you, but we can read for you the captions and explanations of this gallery of death. Pictures of torture. Victims of the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. Abstract words, unembellished, nameless, naming the dead.
This exhibit displays photos of detainees from the prisons run by Syrian authorities that were taken
by a defector from the Syrian army who is known by the pseudonym Caesar.
Upon thorough analysis by a first-rate legal and forensic team, it was concluded that over 55,000
photos Caesar smuggled out of Syria documented at least 11,000 deaths under detainment.
The pictures are unimaginably gruesome, bodies treated like torn sacks with the life emptied from them in the worst way. Who were they?
Male.
Death attributed, Syrian authorities, intelligence branch 227.
Child.
Death attributed, Syrian authorities, intelligence branch 215.
Female.
Death attributed, Syrian authorities, intelligence branch 215.
Elderly male.
Death attributed, Syrian authorities, intelligence branch 235.
Bones askew, eyes torn away, mouths crushed. A sleeping face of a child whose end came after an uncountable series of burns. Broken skin, a dark, filthy red. The yellow-gray of death. Rooms full of such bodies. Pictures smuggled out of Syria. Ambassador Power has her own quiet moment with the photos. She slowly steps past each shot, looking and then looking away. And then she sits and joins us for a few moments.
Well, it's hard to find words after walking through that exhibit. Repulsive, outrageous, enraging. I mean, what can one say? Old people, women, kids, this regime has no shame.
Is the removal of this regime in Syria and the fight against ISIS consistent policy goals?
Absolutely. For as long as the Assad regime has been in power, Syria has been a magnet for extremists and terrorists and people who want to avenge the crimes that he is committing. So it will be extremely challenging to bring about the destruction of ISIS for as long as he is continuing to carry out brutality like this, and it'll be impossible for there to be peace in the region while he is ruling in the manner, again, by torturing, by putting barrel bombs on children's heads. I mean, this is not a regime whose existence, whose perpetuation is compatible with peace.
What do you say to people who say that Assad is fighting ISIS as hard as the United States is, but for very different reasons, and that that's something we're going to have to reconcile?
I think if Assad had been fighting ISIS over the last 2 or 3 years, we wouldn't have the problem we have with ISIS. In fact, the regime has exerted far more energy torturing civilians in its facilities and throwing barrel bombs out of helicopters onto civilian neighborhoods than it has fighting ISIS. So while the Assad regime's rhetoric has been about fighting terrorism, all that it has in fact done is allow terrorists to flourish within its territory, and its brutality has, again, strengthened the cause of terrorists who seek to recruit people to their cause.
Does the United States have any channel to the Bashar al-Assad regime?
We informed Assad before we began an air campaign about what it was we were doing and warned his forces not to shoot at our planes, but that is the extent of it.
Should there be a channel?
There needs to be a political solution, and the UN has been attempting, through engagements with both the Syria regime on the one hand and the opposition on the other, to try to get things going again in the political space. But while Assad feels he has the backing of Iran and Russia, it is hard for the UN or for a gathering of countries that would include the United States to change his calculus. And so someone certainly needs to have a channel with the Assad regime, because the Assad regime has to be willing to engage in dialogue and bring about a transition, and Assad will need to step down, which is going to require engagement with him. But again, for as long as those negotiations occur and he knows he's got a blank check from Iran and Russia, it's going to be challenging to change his calculus.
We're close to a deal with Iran on nukes. What you've said about Iran's support for Assad, how does that complicate either this situation or the nuclear situation?
Well, the negotiations in Geneva are strictly about Iran's nuclear program and trying to find a way to peacefully deny them a pathway to a nuclear weapon. That is a very challenging assignment in its own right and a very important one. Even in the event we are to get a deal, nobody for a minute think that that in any way mitigates how we should respond to Iran's bad behavior in other respects. The UN Human Rights Report on Iran this year is as bad as any we've ever seen. The number of executions has increased actually quite substantially over the last year and a half. So whether it's support for Assad, support for Hezbollah and other non-state actors, support for destabilizing elements across the Middle East, or internal human rights practices, we will continue to maintain the same policies that we have over many years, which is to push Iran to be a more responsible member of the international community. And any sanctions that are put in place for reasons other than the nuclear program will remain in place.
When you leave, I'm going to go over there and take a picture of one of those pictures. I'm going to take it home to my 16-year-old daughter. I'm going to show it to her. And the first thing she's going to ask me is somebody doing something about this? What would you say to her?
Well, we're doing a lot. We are spending billions of dollars feeding people, and we are providing support to the Syrians who are trying to fight not only terrorism, but also the regime that has perpetrated these monstrous acts. What we're not doing yet, what we have not succeeded in doing yet, is ending the conflict, which is what, given the brutality of this regime, until the regime is no longer in power, until a political settlement has been achieved, they have proven themselves capable of only fighting one way, and that's with blatant disregard for people's dignity, for their lives, and for any of the international norms that we thought were picking up, making progress over the course of the 20th and into the 21st century. So what you can tell your daughter is we're never going to give up, and a regime that commits acts like this will eventually be held accountable. It may feel like that day is a ways off right now because this regime has, again, tragically, the support of two powerful countries, but the day will come, and we have the evidence, we know who's responsible, and they will be held to account.
Ambassador Power, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Washington's ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, speaking to The Takeaway last Friday. Ambassador Power says she wants to break the deadlock over dealing with the Syrian regime in Damascus. She says the fight against ISIS complicates matters in Syria, but there is nothing complicated about the human rights violations taking place under the Assad regime. In an interview with the Associated Press later on Friday, she elaborated on her criticism of Russia, describing Russian vetoes against action in the Security Council as extremely disruptive to the diplomatic process of bringing the civil war to an end, or at least accomplishing what was once the sole mission in Syria for the United States and the Allies, bringing down the Assad regime. Samantha Power did not elaborate on her remarks on Iran's support for Syria beyond what she told us. Syria's conflict is starting its fifth year. Hard to believe. More than 200,000 have been killed. Ambassador Power says at the very least, President Assad should be referred to the International Criminal Court for war crimes, but even that is impossible in the current deadlock. As Ambassador Power walked off to another meeting and another bit of diplomacy before her weekend began, she took one last look at the disturbing photos on the wall. All of us understood that there was nothing in the cards at this point with any prospect of stopping the torture and killing in Syria, which will mean that Caesar, the anonymous dissident with his camera, will have more pictures to take, more images to send to the West, more silent pleas from the dead to do something for the living. Experience not required. Barack Obama proved it by becoming president after only 4 years in the U.S. Senate. Now a 44-year-old constitutional law expert with less experience, about half that amount of experience in Washington, D.C., wants to do it as a Republican. The junior senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, announced his candidacy for president at a packed Liberty University arena in Lynchburg, Virginia.
I am announcing that I'm running for president of the United States.
Cruz invoked his faith in Jesus Christ. He told the story of his immigrant family. He vowed to work to create a flat tax and abolish the IRS, seal the U.S. border, give unwavering support to Israel, and defeat radical Islam. Is Ted Cruz a momentum builder for the GOP or a fringe candidate who will pull the base in the early primaries? Joining me now, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. What do you think? He's certainly the first one in.
He's the first one in. He's the first one to declare and preempting some of his other Senate colleagues who are expected to run. Oh, look, people like Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, other senators, John, expected to run for president, are expected to make their announcements during the coming Easter Passover spring recess. 2 weeks, perfect time for senators to get on the campaign trail when they don't have as many senatorial duties. Well, Ted Cruz just preempted them all. So you ask, is he a candidate from the fringe or from the center of the party? I don't know about fringe, but certainly a candidate from the right. In his appeal at Liberty University, John, Ted Cruz called on courageous conservatives to stand together for liberty. He called on born-again Christians to join him.
Today, roughly half of born-again Christians aren't voting. They're staying home. Imagine instead millions of people of faith all across America coming out to the polls and voting our values.
Now, is John, he suggesting there the demographic formula that basically a lot of Christians have stayed home since the Republicans have walked away from a lot of the values issues of the Reagan years?
Yeah, John, that's Ted Cruz's answer to his critics who say he's too conservative to win, that he could do well in an early primary when the base gets excited, but that in a general election there just aren't enough conservatives to propel somebody like Ted Cruz into the presidency. That's his answer. He says a lot of core conservatives, a lot of born-again Christians aren't voting, and I'm going to give him a reason to do it.
And he sounded a little like John Lennon with his campaign sort of chorus here. Here's him talking about Obamacare.
Imagine in 2017, a new president signing legislation repealing every word of Obamacare.
Keyword there, imagine.
Imagine a president who says we will stand up and defeat radical Islamic terrorism, and we will call it by its name.
So can the big money contributors imagine Ted Cruz making it through the primary races?
That's the perfect question, because right now Ted Cruz is imagining a lot of small donors and grassroots money. He gave out a text number for people to text support and text him some money for his campaign. And he better do it, because early on, the big money, such as it is right now, is going to two places in the Republican field. It's going to Jeb Bush and to Scott Walker. Now, that can change, but Ted Cruz isn't expecting a great deal of support from the biggest money in the Republican field. He's been a disruptor in the Senate. He's upset the Republican establishment and the Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate. That's his track record. He's proud of it. He's not running away from it. But that's not the kind of track record that attracts the big money that's at the core of the Republican Party. And also, Ted Cruz has staked out some populist anti-corporate positions, so they're not going to be excited about his candidacy either, John.
And some big contributors might be concerned about his reading childhood stories on C-SPAN when the government shutdown and his filibuster was stopping everything in Washington. But one of his supporters, Peggy Venable, who we talked to today, said that, no, that was an act of political heroism.
I think the fact that he was filibustering, the fact that this senator is willing to take a bold step to call out Obama's lawlessness and to really be a dynamic leader on behalf of those of us who believe in the Constitution. I think that's going to go a long way, and it already has, to catapult him into the public spotlight.
Now, she's from the Americans for Prosperity Foundation in Austin, Texas, doesn't speak for the foundation. There's a lot of supporters within the Americans for Prosperity Foundation who are likely Cruz supporters, but they're still making up their minds as well.
Yeah, they are. And I think what Peggy spoke to there is key for the next 18 months of Cruz's campaign while he's in the Senate. Here's why. It's true that his filibusters and disruptive activities in Congress have tried to call out a president who's extremely unpopular on the right. We all know that. But he's also gone headlong challenging the leaders of the Republican Party at every turn, at every crisis of either debt limit or government spending or Obamacare. He has called out Republican leaders, asking them if they're going to keep their promise to voters and have a confrontation with Obama. So the conservatives, Cruz's supporters, love that. The Republican Party establishment doesn't. And John, we're at a point in Congress right now as the party leaders, John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, are trying to steer their conferences, trying to steer Congress to a place where the Republican nominee can run a viable campaign for the whole country, not just the primary. And here's the question. You know, John Boehner has shown signs already of moving his politics a little closer to the center, dealing with Democrats on things like Medicare instead of going right to the Republican base. Ted Cruz is one of the leaders of that conservative base, even in the House. The House members count that senator as their leader. So as Mitch McConnell and certainly John Boehner steer away from that, does that present a liability for Ted Cruz or an opportunity? Every time they go moderate, does he lash against them and prove to conservatives that even the Republican leaders aren't on their side? It's going to be fascinating.
It's interesting because, you know, Ted Cruz, as you say, doesn't have a lot of friends among the leadership there in the Congress. Rand Paul, another possible likely runner for president, doesn't have a lot of friends in the leadership in Congress. Jeb Bush may have more friends among Mitch McConnell and John Boehner than anyone in the likely candidacy right now.
Yeah, he may. And it's fascinating. Maybe, you know, we're not inside their heads, but those leaders from the party establishment may be looking outside of their own ranks for the next president. We don't know that yet. You know, Rand Paul does have a growing list of friends in Congress. I think it's safe to say that among the leaders of the Republican Party, Ted Cruz does not, but he's the first in, and we'll see who else jumps in the next couple of weeks here.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You bet, John.
I want to ask each of you to imagine. Imagine millions of courageous conservatives all across America rising up together. Imagine, instead of economic stagnation, booming, think just how different the world would be.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And when you hear beeps and rhythmic pulses from billions of miles away, you can't resist thinking that it's a message. It's got to be. They are trying to send a message to us here on Earth or something like that. The variable star KIC 5520878 was pulsing, brightening, and then dimming in a six-hour cycle. The fluctuations in brightness, scientists observed, seemed to have a mathematically sophisticated pattern. It has to be a signal, they initially concluded. John Learned, professor of physics at the University of Hawaii Manoa, is with us now from Japan. Professor Learned, what did those pulses originally suggest to you and your colleagues, and tell us what you now believe?
Well, when we were first seeing the signals, we got rather excited because they were making patterns that we found very, very hard to explain. So there was a little while where we were thinking, my God, can we really have found such a thing? But after a while, it settled in that this was a natural phenomenon, even though it seemed to produce prime numbers and all kinds of interesting things. And when I talked to my friends who study chaos theory, they were very excited because they realized right away that we had seen the first natural example of something called a strange non-chaotic oscillator.
All right, but strange non-chaotic oscillator, I mean, that's exciting. But when you said your initial conclusion was this might be a kind of, you know, somebody talking to Jodie Foster, you know, message from the extraterrestrials, right?
Yes, exactly. That we were looking in this class of stars because we had a slightly crazy theory that maybe an extraterrestrial civilization could modulate the pulsations as a way to make a galactic lighthouse. And so we were looking for peculiar pulsations. And with the wonderful data from the Kepler satellite, we were able to see details that people had never seen before.
Let's just say right off the top, a non-chaotic strange attractor is not a bad second prize to extraterrestrials.
It's different, and it's part of the glory of science, you know, that you start out looking for one thing and you find something you didn't expect. And you never know where that's going to lead. And we don't yet know where this is going to lead. And it involves this peculiar ratio called phi, the golden ratio, that has been known since ancient times. And to be honest, we really don't know what this means. We simply know that it isn't something that pops out of the normal calculations about stellar oscillations.
So peculiar stars, extraterrestrial messages, I can't imagine that's your day job. What part of physics actually pays the bills in your household?
Well, of course, I get paid to teach, but in research, I do research on neutrinos, and I'm sitting right now in Japan at the world's largest neutrino experiment where we've measured a number of good things which don't get much press, but they're really solid and wonderful science, and we've had lots and lots of fun with this experiment, but doesn't attract as much attention as strange chaotic stars.
Although a couple of generations ago, the way neutrinos behaved was so bizarre as to make most scientists scratch their heads and go, that's impossible.
Oh, yes, indeed. And this experiment where I am at was the one that really discovered these neutrino oscillations. And neutrinos have this most peculiar ability to shapeshift. They turn from one kind of a neutrino to another as they fly along. And we don't know of any of their particles that do that, and we really don't understand yet. We don't have a grand unified theory that puts neutrinos in context and says why they have mass and why do they oscillate from one type to another as they fly along.
Well, Dr. John Learned, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you for calling.
John Learned is a professor of physics at the University of Hawaii Manoa, a neutrino expert who's working on a neutrino experiment at an observatory in Japan. The Retro Report series takes us back to a passionate but somewhat gruesome debate about doctor-assisted suicide.
I'm doing what a physician is supposed to do.
Dr. Jack Kevorkian felt it was his duty as a physician when he helped 54-year-old Alzheimer's patient Janet Atkins push a button to end her life. Dr. Kevorkian faced four trials for doctor-assisted suicide but was never convicted. But when he went on CBS's 60 Minutes and on national television played a videotape that showed him ending the life of a patient...
Is he dead now?
He's dying now because his oxygen's cut off. He can't breathe. So I'll now quickly inject the potassium chloride to stop the heart.
He's dead.
Yep, the heart has stopped.
That bold expression of his views on doctor-assisted suicide there on national television and the right to die got Jack Kevorkian a prison sentence. He served 8 years.
You had the audacity to go on national television, show the world what you did, and dare the legal system to stop you. Well, sir, consider yourself stopped.
The judge sentencing Kevorkian there. But in 2011, Dr. Kevorkian died of natural causes at age 83. And today, Retro Report asks, what is Kevorkian's legacy in the right to die debate? With me is Jill Rosenbaum, producer for Retro Report. Jill, welcome.
Hi.
So what do you think Dr. Kevorkian did that resonates today in the debate over the right to die?
Well, Dr. Kevorkian was in your face. You know, he got people kind of fixated on the macabre way he did this, but also on the immense suffering that people had at the end of life or people who were being treated for their pain. You know, it was a kind of thing that just hadn't been broadly discussed before. Though, when you look at the actual impact as opposed to the public relations impact, it's much less clear. Other people, including Dr. Timothy Quill from Rochester, New York, who brought the issue to the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1990s, or the folks in Oregon who in 1994 passed the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, they were operating at the exact same time as Dr. Kevorkian, and they actually moved the needle where he didn't.
How would you describe Dr. Timothy Quill? Is he an advocate of Dr. Kevorkian? Is he a fundamentally different sort of style of proponent here? Is he basically using the same argument?
No. And I have to say that even though Dr. Quill started his work in this area, as did the folks in Oregon, while Kevorkian was active, they really did not agree with him at all. They felt that he was unchecked, that his patients often weren't terminally ill, that he wasn't serious in you know, looking at the patient's life and the patient's whole being. It was a very, very different approach.
Much more like the kind of tone that you find in hospice care. Here's Michael Marasco, a cancer patient of Dr. Timothy Quill.
It's very intolerable. You're doing this, just making me comfortable, prolonging the inevitable, and that's not the way I want to go. Just say goodbye to your loved ones, take a shot, go to sleep, and not wake up. And it should be my right.
In terms of the rights, where does this stand legally, and how much is it likely to change in the next decade or so?
Well, so far, there are 5 states where physicians can help their patients and their lives: Oregon, Washington, Vermont, Montana, and New Mexico. There are a slew of states that have now got legislation pending. Where that will go, I have no idea. Dr. Quill has joined a new lawsuit in the state of New York asking that physicians not be prosecuted if they help their patients in this way. You know, there is a new movement to look at this again right now, but I have no idea where it's going to go.
But certainly, Kevorkian had a hand in getting it all started.
In terms of the public awareness, there is absolutely no question. And one thing that everyone agrees on is that from 25 years ago to today, the care of suffering patients and dying patients has improved dramatically. That one of the things that Dr. Quill, Dr. Kevorkian, the Oregon folks, all the attention that they put, it made it easier to give people pain medicine that could potentially end their lives, where in the past doctors were afraid to give, say, too much morphine because if the patient died, they could be prosecuted for killing them. So there were a lot of things not even related to death that came out of this discussion that I think was very helpful to a lot of people.
Jill Rosenbaum is a Retro Report producer. Thanks so much, Jill.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So who sees poetry in the numbers and jargon of tax returns? Novelist David Foster Wallace had the capacity to see that poetry. Here he speaks in the voice of a rather philosophical IRS accountant. I'll read it. There's something very interesting about civics and selfishness, and we get to ride the crest of it. Here in the U.S., we expect government and law to be our conscience, our superego, you could say. It has something to do with liberal individualism and something to do with capitalism, but I don't understand much in the theoretical aspect of what I see. It's what I live in. Americans are, in a way, crazy. We think of ourselves as citizens when it comes to our rights and privileges, but not to our responsibilities. We abdicate our civic responsibilities to the government and expect the government, in effect, to legislate morality. That's the late author David Foster Wallace from his posthumous novel The Pale King, who found an intricate story in the arcane depths of the tax code, the story of an IRS employee at the Regional Examination Center in Peoria, Illinois. Arthur Caulfield is tax law professor at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and the author of a forthcoming paper in the Pittsburgh Tax Review titled David Foster Wallace on Tax Policy, How to Be an Adult and Other Mysteries of the Universe. Congratulations, Mr. Caulfield.
Well, thank you.
You've really put some things together here. What are other tax experts likely to make of your paper, do you think?
You know, I'll have to wait and see, of course, until it's published. I've got a draft version online, and I'm hearing some very positive comments. I think that folks like myself, who are tax lawyers and tax academics, will be attracted to this project because most people would run away from us like we had the plague when we start talking about taxation. So it's always nice to see an essay on this topic within our little industry.
What did you find in the words of David Foster Wallace? The Pale King was published posthumously and wasn't all written. I mean, it was all written by him, but it was put together, assembled by one of his editors at the very end there.
That's right. He actually worked on it for 14 years, 1994 to 2008, when he committed suicide. And his editor, who was the same editor for his novel Infinite Jest, had to complete this so-called unfinished novel. And because it was unfinished, I was appointed in 2013 to the University of Texas at Austin. The Ransom Center at this university had purchased Wallace's collected works. And so I spent a semester sifting through his notes, his accounting notes, his background notes, and all the various thoughts he had on this project, in part because it was unfinished. I wanted to see if the editor had assimilated his views properly into this final project.
So you were fact-checking to a certain extent. You were sort of truth-telling, truth-checking. But did you also get intrigued and, in a sense, fall in love with Wallace's philosophical thread here?
Absolutely. You know, it wasn't just a fact check. I'm a huge fan of Wallace. I've read his other two novels. This was actually only his third novel. And so it gave me a chance as a fan to kind of sift through his works. And I did find it a bittersweet experience. In one sense, it was inspiring. You got to see how this genius collected his thoughts and rendered them in such extraordinary prose into the final project. But on the other hand, of course, when you're looking through these notes, you realize that Wallace is gone, that he's committed suicide, and this will be it. You know, one of the strange aspects of the project is I almost felt myself at times being angry with Wallace. You know, how could he do this to me? How could he do this to us? You know, it was somewhat irrational, but nevertheless, I felt that way.
I felt in reading the book that he was really on to something, that the nameless, anonymous clerks who sit in cubicles and constitute the cogs and wheels of America's government or whatever bureaucracy you want to name, have so often and were certainly characterized during the 20th century as being part of some monstrous death force that denied all of us individuality. And here's Wallace finding in such a character this kind of humanity. And it's an homage to someone like you, who is a tax law professor. So personally, I would have imagined that it would have an emotional connection to you. But it also says something very happy about things that we don't view happy at all.
Absolutely. There's so many different interesting aspects of this project. One, of course, is you're exactly right. He infuses the lives of these tax bureaucrats at the IRS with almost a kind of heroism. I mean, when one thinks these guys are tax accountants, these men and women, when one thinks of this profession, you know, the typical reaction would be, oh my God, that's extraordinarily tedious, banal, mundane. And yet, to Wallace, no, that traditional narrative is absolutely incorrect, that these folks are more like heroes, and the work that they do has an important impact on the lives of ordinary Americans.
And each one of those ordinary Americans' returns is sort of like an X-ray of their citizenship, their belief in government, their cynicism about government, their faith in government. It's all there in the numbers.
Yes, and I think one of the things that he was trying to suggest was that previous generations of Americans, or maybe in my case Canadians, viewed this filling out of the return almost with, as a moral obligation. But now, as you've suggested earlier, it's all about, well, how much can I game the system? How much can I get away with? We hear that Mitt Romney's beaten his tax bill down to almost nothing. How about me?
Before we go, do you think there's a way back to that very Canadian-sounding faith in, you know, doing your tax return is almost a sacred act?
I don't know. I don't want to be overly cynical about this topic, but I think we may that earlier era of sacrifice may be gone forever. I mean, one of the things that Wallace examines in The Pale King is the ongoing wealth produced by our culture and the impact of that, and maybe, as he viewed it, an almost selfishness that follows this enhanced wealth. And so I don't know if we can ever go back. I think we're stuck with exactly Wallace's perspective for the time being, for the next few generations. But who knows? I mean, in his mind, he characterized this as the end of the democracy experiment, this selfishness. So It is quite troubling.
Arthur Cofield is a tax law professor at Queen's University with some thoughts about the late David Foster Wallace and his posthumous novel, The Pale King, all about an IRS accountant at a regional processing facility in Peoria, Illinois. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Finally, here's something to take with you today. What will hackers make of the president spotted this weekend wearing a Fitbit Surge smartwatch that keeps track of heart rate, calorie count, and of course the number of steps one takes in a given day? It can also get texts and call notifications. Could someone hack into the Fitbit and substitute the heart rate of a hummingbird or a hippo? With Bluetooth, could a prank-minded citizen message the president that his calorie count is too high? Or grab his GPS location and send it to Jon Stewart? Or Fox News? Is everything I am suggesting actually already a federal felony? We assume the Fitbit will connect to a .gov issued email account, and I suppose the Situation Room. Call us with your situation, your Obama sightings at 877-8MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Hockenberry, or check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I am John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.